This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. HB2 has been as costly as it has been controversial, perhaps more so. And we've reached an impasse between the city of Charlotte and the legislature. So later in the program, we hear from two politicians on opposite sides of the issue about what needs to happen next and who must make the first move if we want to end this impasse. First, a different kind of controversy. Dylan Roof, the man accused of killing 9 people in a Bible study class at Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church, is about to go on trial. He has attorneys, but last week they took a back seat to Roof as he represented himself in the jury selection phase of his federal hate crimes trial. In fact, Mr. Roof had told the judge that in the death penalty trial he intended to represent himself throughout the process. But yesterday, Roof filed a motion asking the judge to let his defense team represent him again, but only through the guilt phase. He wishes to represent himself during the sentencing phase. Self-representation is a constitutional right, but a dangerous one, particularly when the stakes are so high. So why would he want to do this? What complications might this lead to during the trial process? And has this ever worked out for defendants in the past? To get some answers, we've invited two attorneys to join us. Noel Tin is founder and managing partner of Tin, Fulton, Walker, and Owen, whose work in the courtroom on behalf of defendants has attracted the attention of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, ABC News, CBS TV 60 Minutes, and the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
He is in our Spirit Square studio, and with us by phone is Charlotte native James Coleman, professor of law and director for the Center for Criminal Justice and Professional Responsibility at Duke University School of Law. He represented serial killer Ted Bundy during the appellate process in the 1980s. Bundy had represented himself during that earlier trial, and he joins us, I guess, from Durham. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, good morning and welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Noel. Dylan Roof has been representing himself, as I said, during the jury selection phase of the trial, although he does have counsel and has had counsel seated either beside him at the table or behind him in the first row. In your experience, when life is at stake, why would a defendant choose to represent himself at any stage of the trial process?
I think every case is different. There are a lot of reasons that a defendant might make this decision. It's rare, but it happens. It could be distrust of the legal system in general. It could be distrust of a particular lawyer or lawyers. It could be an attempt to make a political statement. In this case, standby counsel had filed a motion suggesting that Mr. Roof may be trying to sabotage the trial and get the death penalty by presenting no mitigation.
So this is what some people have referred to as suicide by jury. This is what he wants?
Well, it's possible. I don't know. But there have been motions filed that suggest that that is a possibility at least.
What about a simple desire to be able to use the – because he doesn't know legal procedure – to use the courtroom as a place in which he can vent his white supremacist views ad nauseum?
It's possible. There are a whole lot of possibilities, but absent a specific reason to think that's the case, I think it's speculative.
So, James Coleman, you represented, as I said, Ted Bundy in the appellate phase of his trial. He was permitted to defend himself in his original trial, although the court did appoint an attorney to act as standby counsel. But he'd been a law student. Ted Bundy had gone to law school. And I'm told he is considered to have done a reasonably good job of representing himself. But why did he do it, and did that decision have any effect on the outcome of his trial?
Yes, I'm surprised that you've been told that he did a reasonably good job.
I read that somewhere. I don't.
Yeah.
He didn't, evidently.
You know, he did not. And, you know, it is the reason that he has been executed. You know, he sabotaged a plea agreement that the lawyers had worked out for him by ignoring their advice and ignoring the threat by the state that, you know, if he engaged in any independent conduct during the plea agreement proceedings, that they would withdraw the plea. And that's exactly what happened. I think one factor that I would add to the list of things that might cause a person to represent himself is mental illness. I think that was the case with Ted Bundy. And it actually became the basis on which we got an evidentiary hearing on whether he had been competent to stand trial during those periods.
And evidently, the threshold for competence, and I don't know whether this is a federal characteristic or whether this is true in trials at all levels of the judicial system, but one of you believes, and maybe it's both of you who believe, that the test for competence is pretty low.
Unquestionably, it's very low. In federal court, it's set out by statute. It's able to understand the nature of the proceedings. In other words, what's the judge there to do? What's the prosecutor there to do? And assisting your defense, as a practical matter, a very, very small percentage of defendants, even mentally ill defendants, are found incapable of proceeding. And so you have a lot of people go through the system found capable of proceeding who have severe mental health issues.
What would Dylann Roof's decision over the weekend, yesterday, Sunday, say to you about his mental health? He's been through this jury selection phase. They're about to go into the guilt phase of the trial, which is the trial itself. And now he says, maybe I should have my attorney do this or attorneys do this. What would that tell you about his thought process, either of you?
Well, I'm not sure it tells you anything. It would be speculation. Trying to figure out why he did that, but the two phases of the trial in which he would have had the most direct contact with the jury are the jury selection phase and then the mitigation phase, when ordinarily his lawyers would put on evidence to try to explain why he committed the crimes that he did. In a way that would generate sympathy on the part of the jurors. It's easy to speculate that maybe what he's trying to do is, as you described it, suicide by jury.
Both of you are defense attorneys. What could he possibly say? What can an attorney possibly say in this particular case that would gain the sympathy of the jury?
What could they say?
Yeah.
You'd be surprised. There are a number of cases. I mean, there's a case, not recently, but within the last few years in Georgia, where an individual killed a judge, a courtroom official kidnapped a woman and was sentenced to life in prison. It depends on what evidence there is of his background, his mental health, which, apparently, he fought with his lawyers over whether to get into that during the phase of the proceedings when the judge decided whether he was competent to stand trial. Even in a case that seems clear-cut on the guilt phase can nevertheless result in a life sentence, depending on what experienced lawyers are able to present in the mitigation phase.
Noel Tin, there's a question floating out there on the part of a lot of people, but it's been verbalized here by Bill, who emails us today, that please explain why this drawn-out trial is even necessary. Since Dylann Roof has admitted guilt, the families of the victims have forgiven him. They don't want a trial, and to top it off, it's scheduled over the holiday season. Who benefits from this trial beside the attorneys getting paid to litigate it?
Well, we have a system in which guilt is determined by trial. In a capital case, the sentence is also determined by a jury. So I don't think we want to start taking shortcuts in cases that we think are clear-cut, particularly in a capital case where the public has no idea what mitigating evidence there might be in an individual's background.
And Noel Tin, is part of the reason for having this trial the fact that the defense attorneys asked for life if he admitted guilt to the 33 counts that the federal government has put up against him, and they don't want to do that. They want the prosecutors want to go forward. Is that the real reason for this, or the primary reason for this? Because if he had said, if they had accepted that, there would be no trial, correct? Or a very short one.
Yes, I mean, that has to be a factor. Preliminarily, I do want to address one part of that email. Capital defense work never has been, and certainly is not now, lucrative in any by the standards of anybody in the legal profession. It is certainly I don't think getting paid is a factor that's driving the trial.
Then why do lawyers do it? Because he has a fairly high profile defense panel behind him, his case. Why would they do it? Why do they do it?
I think they do it because of opposition to the death penalty. I think David Brook has been doing this for decades. Mm-hmm. He is one of the consensus top defense attorneys in the country.
He defended the Boston Marathon bomber.
Yes. And when he does these cases, he does them on a court-appointed basis. And that means go ahead, Jim.
I agree with that. I think the other reason they do it is because they want to make sure that the defendant gets a fair trial. Often in capital cases, defendants are appointed lawyers who are not experienced and often not very good in the complexities of a capital case. And these lawyers take on these difficult cases in order to make sure that the system works. It's certainly not. It's not done for the money. I can assure you of that.
Yeah. When a defendant asks to represent himself, does the judge always have to say yes, you can, because it's a constitutionally protected right, or can he say in some cases you're not equipped in one way or another to do this, and therefore your attorneys will have to do it for you? Is that an option?
The judge is
In
the broadest terms, the judge is required to allow somebody to represent themselves as long as they don't find that the request is made to delay the trial, to obstruct the trial proceedings, and there's what the law calls a knowing and intelligent waiver of the right to counsel, which basically means that somebody doesn't have to have the skill of a lawyer, but they need to be advised of the risks and disadvantages of proceeding.
I want to come back to that, but when a defendant makes this request and the judge feels he has to, or he or she has to grant that request because of the law, that would seem to me thrusts the trial itself into some sort of peril, does it not? Because procedurally, an untrained defendant defending him or herself could do something that would cause a mistrial, would it not? Could that not happen?
Yes, I mean, that's certainly possible. And, you know, the other thing that could happen is that during the period that the defendant is representing himself, he may also raise questions about whether he has a rational understanding of what's going on. I mean, I agree that the standard for competency is very low. But once the proceeding starts, then the defendant's behavior becomes a factor, and if it appears that he is acting irrationally, I think that would require the judge on his own motion to revisit the question of competence.
James Coleman is a professor of law at Duke University School of Law, and Noel Tin is with us as well. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Hip Hop Nutcracker, reimagining Tchaikovsky's classic score through hip hop dance, December 27th through the 30th at Knight Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And Bojangles, celebrating families this time of year with the Holiday Family Variety Feast, available all day at area Bojangles. Well, the EPA, a private company called Aclima, and Google Earth are working together to provide hyper-local air quality monitoring in cities around the country. And it just so happens that Charlotte is one of those cities. And when this special technology arrives, we're going to learn more about the most polluted parts of our city. And that could help planners design healthier, cleaner developments. We're going to meet some of the principal players in this triumvirate to find out more on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President-elect Trump's choice for Defense Secretary, retired Marine Corps General James Mattis, is known for his tough stance on Iran and ISIS. He needs a special congressional waiver to take the post, a look at Trump's cabinet pick, and what it would mean for U.S. military strategy.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Noel Tin is with us, founder and managing partner of Tin, Fulton, Walker & Owen, and James Coleman, professor of law and director of the Center for Criminal Justice and Professional Responsibility at the Duke University School of Law. He represented Ted Bundy, the serial killer, in his sentencing phase, in the appellate phase, excuse me, of his trial. We're talking about the Dylann Roof trial in Charleston, and over the weekend, yesterday, Dylann Roof, who had been representing himself in the jury selection portion of the trial and who had said he wanted to represent himself in the entire trial, wrote this handwritten note on a piece of lined paper to the judge, which said, "Dear Judge Gergel, I would like to ask if my lawyers can represent me for the guilt phase of the trial only, underlined. Can you let me have them back for the guilt phase and then let me represent myself for the sentencing phase of the trial? If you would allow that, then that is what I would like to do." Dylann Roof, 12-4-16. And I'm reading this. It's a copy of the actual note. It's kind of creepy. If you were the judge, and he has not ruled on this yet, it's Monday morning, is he likely to say yes to this? No.
I think it's likely. I think as long as the trial can move along in something approximating the schedule that they had planned on, that it is likely that the judge would grant that request.
So if his attorneys are allowed to resume their representation during the guilt phase, but he takes back the reins for the sentencing phase, would that mean that Dylann Roof could then suppress any information about his mental state that a good defense lawyer might bring out during that phase of the trial, James? Can they only bring that up, for instance, during the sentencing, or could that come up in the guilt phase of the trial?
Well, it depends on what the defense is, but it's most likely that it would have come up in the penalty phase of the trial. I don't think he is a certain insanity as a defense. So because I don't think he will allow them to get into his mental condition. So by controlling the penalty phase of the trial, he absolutely controls any evidence relating to his mental health that would be brought up. I don't think the state would bring up any.
This is pure speculation, obviously, because we have no idea what's going on behind the scenes in this trial or between Dylann Roof and his attorneys. But what kinds of conversations have likely been going on between Mr. Roof and his attorneys to make this request of yesterday to get them involved again in the process? What would you be saying, Noel, to Dylann Roof right now? As an attorney?
Well, I think the starting point would be having a conversation about why he thinks it's a good idea to proceed without representation. And I think that's what everybody is curious about. And I think that a lawyer appointed to represent him or a standby counsel would ask, why is it that this is what you want to do?
Would there have been something that happened during the jury selection phase that might have triggered an impulse in Dylann Roof where he came to a realization suddenly that, you know, maybe I'm not equipped to do this. Maybe this is too complex for somebody who has no law degree and who, in fact, I believe, dropped out of high school?
He may have decided that. It's hard to know. It's hard to know in a lot of these cases just reading a record and reading pleadings.
Colin Ferguson, who's the man found guilty of the Long Island Railroad massacre in which 25 people were shot by Ferguson and six of them died, he represented himself, and during his trial he questioned some of his victims on the stand. What are the optics of that? How do juries react to that kind of cross-examination from the guy who has been accused of these acts?
Very, very badly. And I think in the Ted Bundy trial, that was a big factor in not only his cross-examination of victims or people who were related to them, but also his cross-examination of crime scene technicians when, you know, his cross-examination appeared to be reliving the crime itself. And, you know, I think for a defendant who's not going to take the stand, I think it turns off the jury quite a bit for the defendant to be actively involved in that way.
I want to get back to this competency test that the courts apply to see whether you're competent to stand trial. He was declared competent to stand trial. Fundamentally, that means what?
Well, there are two aspects of competence. One is that he has a factual understanding of what's going on, and that's a really low standard. I think you would have to be seriously mentally ill in order not to understand factually what's going on. You know, who the defendant is, who the prosecutor is, the jury, the judge, things like that. The other, though, is that he has a rational understanding of the proceeding, and that one gets into his cognitive ability and whether that has been impaired in any way. That's why I say that it's possible during the course of his self-representation that things could happen that would indicate that he's not acting rationally in light of what's at stake.
The Supreme Court has made it clear that people have the right to defend themselves as long as the decision, and I believe, Noel, you referred to this phrase a moment ago, as long as the decision is made knowingly and intelligently. That's a quote. So is this right, Noel, something that is enshrined in the Constitution itself, one that was merely permitted by the court after a ruling, or did that Supreme Court ruling simply amplify an already constitutionally protected right?
So since 1975, in a case called Feretta versus California, it has been a Sixth Amendment right to represent yourself. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that a corollary of the right to have counsel is the right to have no counsel, and that all the rights that an accused has to be present, to confront witnesses, they belong to the accused and not to the lawyer. And so for that reason, the accused can represent himself.
It would seem to me that this is not a good example of a good time to represent oneself if you're up for a death penalty in a death penalty trial. But are there instances where it does make sense for a defendant to represent themselves?
I don't think it's a question of whether it makes sense or not. The question is whether a person can effectively represent himself in a particular case. And, you know, I'm sure that there are instances where both a lawyer and a non-lawyer could competently represent him or herself, but certainly not in a capital case because of the complexity of it and because of the, you know, importance of being able to get to the penalty phase and have a chance to avoid a death sentence.
Dylan Roof allegedly shot 9 strangers who had been nice to him during a Bible study session. He had African-American friends both in real life and on Facebook, and yet he was is a self-avowed white supremacist. To me, that doesn't compute, and yet he was deemed competent to stand trial and now has been representing himself up to this point. Colin Ferguson, the man accused of and convicted of the Long Island Railroad massacre, tried to convince the jury that someone had planted a computer chip in his brain, and that is why he did what he did. Noel, that brings up questions of competency, and yet he was declared competent to stand trial. How do you explain that?
Yeah, you kind of read my mind because that crystallizes how low the standard is in my mind. The notion that somebody could be competent to represent themselves and try to introduce that kind of testimony in a proceeding that serious.
Mm-hmm. So if you're a judge sitting on the bench and you've ruled competency in the case of an individual and you've allowed him because he's requested the opportunity to represent himself and then during the course of the trial, he begins to make outrageous statements that would indicate some mental imbalance. Do you have any recourse? Can the judge say, okay, this is not what we thought it was? At least, at the very least, we need to have your attorney represent you.
The judge can revisit the issue.
Yes.
If the judge, I think the judge actually has an obligation to revisit the issue.
He does, yes.
And so, yes, but you can imagine what a difficult situation that is when these kinds of things happen in the middle of a trial.
So if there's something in Dylan Roof's background, whether he was abused as a child, we have no evidence of that, or whether he certainly had trouble in school. He was a very transient student. He went back and forth. His parents were separated, so he went back and forth from school systems in the Columbia area of South Carolina. He does have these white supremacist views, which the majority of people would see as a mental problem, but maybe not. I'm just saying, but many people would see it that way. Is there anything in his background that would indicate to the judge that perhaps he's not competent at this point to stand trial, or that something he may have said during the jury selection phase would indicate that he needs to bring attorneys back into this?
Well, apparently not. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that he intended to do it this way from the very beginning. In other words, that he would control the jury selection and then stop participating until the penalty phase. That certainly could have been his strategy all along. But on the question of whether his behavior during the trial might signal to the judge that he needs to revisit competence, that's absolutely a fact that may come up or may have come up, and the failure of the judge to do it would be a constitutional error. So, notwithstanding the disruption of something like that, I think the judge definitely has to watch carefully what is going on to determine whether it appears that he's been controlled by something other than rational thought.
And I read yesterday that it's not uncommon, let's put it that way, it's not uncommon for defendants not to want a picture of mental incompetence to be painted of them in a courtroom, even if it's true and may help them in their trial. Why? Why wouldn't they want to use all the tools in the toolkit, particularly if it's true?
Because it goes against self-image. A lot of people who are mentally ill don't want to acknowledge that. That was a driving factor for Ted Bundy. The first time he allowed anybody to raise an issue relating to his mental health was when we represented him after he had been convicted and sentenced to death. When the issue was brought up at his trial, he talked the judge into allowing him to have special counsel appointed to argue against the motion that he might be incompetent to stand trial. And the judge did it. So everybody who participated in his competency hearing argued that he was competent to stand trial.
We have to end this segment, but I have a final question for Noel Tin. Does this ever work out for defendants, particularly in high-profile cases, for defendants to defend themselves? Ever?
I'm sure there's been a case or two where that's happened, but it has got to be the very, very small percentage.
And both of you agree that the judge is likely to agree to Dylan Roof's request for representation again in the guilt phase of this trial.
Hopefully this isn't famous last words, but I think it's likely.
Yeah, I agree.
James Coleman is professor of law and director of the Center for Criminal Justice and Professional Responsibility at the Duke University School of Law. He joined us by phone. And Noel Tin is in our studio here at Spirit Square, founder and managing partner of Tin, Fulton, Walker, and Owen. Thank you both very much. If Pat McCrory loses his bid for re-election as governor of North Carolina, part of the blame will most certainly fall on the passage and signing of HB 2. It may have cost him the governor's mansion, but it has certainly cost Charlotte and other parts of the state millions of dollars in both real costs as well as hits to our image and prestige. Were politics not involved, this bill would most certainly already have found its way to the dustbin of history, given our normal impulse to make money. But this bill is awash in politics, and those for and against the legislation have drawn a line in the sand, with neither side willing to budge a fraction of an inch. Republicans say that Charlotte must make the first move. After all, Charlotte started all of this with passage of an ordinance that would have permitted transgendered individuals to use the restroom of the gender with which they identify. But the legislature's response went much further than overturning the Charlotte ordinance, and Charlotte officials say the state could easily repeal HB 2 without Charlotte taking action of any kind. We are at an impasse, and John Autry and Scott Stone find themselves on opposite sides. So we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking to them about how we might move beyond all of this. John Autry was a Charlotte City Council member, a Democrat, who had a front row seat to the birth of this Charlotte ordinance. Now he's moving to Raleigh as the representative of District 100, which includes East and Southeast Charlotte. Thank you for being here this morning. Welcome back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Scott Stone is a Republican representing North Carolina House District 105, or Southern Mecklenburg. He was appointed to the seat in May and was elected to a full term this year. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
So were you in the legislature?
I was not.
You were not. What was your immediate impression as a Charlottean, as somebody from South Charlotte, when it was passed? Did you agree with it?
I guess I didn't have a strong opinion on the bill itself. I know it was a reaction to the bathroom ordinance that was passed a few weeks earlier, so I understood the rationale for it. Frankly, I think many people throughout the city had hoped that there would not be that bathroom ordinance passed, and there was a lot of opposition to it, as I think most council members were receiving emails on an 8-to-1, you know, or phone calls on an 8-to-1 basis saying, please don't pass this ordinance. So it certainly was a reaction to that.
Okay. John, when city council debated and passed this ordinance, which ultimately led to the passage of HB 2 in Raleigh, was any thought given to the possible intended or unintended consequences of this ordinance?
Certainly, the consequences had been communicated from the governor to a couple of members of the council. We had heard from members of the legislature. But their initial argument was that Charlotte did not have the right to even have a non-discrimination ordinance. And Charlotte originally passed a non-discrimination ordinance in 1968. So there was a precedent for the city having such protections for people.
Did you think it would simply be ignored by the legislature? Did you think they would try to come back and say repeal it or do something else? Did you think they would take an action like the one that they have taken?
The anticipation of the action could have been just to address the provisions around public accommodations for transgender people. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it went much, much further than that.
Which we can talk about. Does it surprise you that we are at this impasse, yes or no?
Yes.
Does it surprise you, Scott, that we are at this impasse, yes or no?
It doesn't surprise me that we're at this impasse, knowing all the behind the scenes.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back and explore this issue further in just a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina's healthcare system's HealthWorks, working with employers to improve the bottom line through innovative employee health solutions. carolinashealthcare.org/HealthWorks. Retired Marine Corps General James Mattis is known for his tough stance on Iran and ISIS, but because he's recently been active duty, President-elect Trump's choice for defense secretary needs a special congressional waiver to take the post. So, on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, a look at Trump's cabinet pick and what it would mean for U.S. military strategy and whether or not the Congress will let him have the job. We'll talk about that coming up. We're going to continue our conversation about HB 2 and hear from people on both sides of the impasse statements.
This is Robert Siegel. All Things Considered is more than just headlines. We take the time to explore the why and how of a story, finding context and perspectives on the news that you simply don't hear elsewhere. We take the time to understand why a story is important and why it matters to you. All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear the latest news from NPR plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to John Autry, a Democrat, former Charlotte City Council person, now in the State House, and Scott Stone, Republican in the State House in Raleigh, about HB2 and the impasse we find ourselves in over the passage of this and the refusal of Charlotte to repeal its ordinance, which led to the passage of HB2. Scott, I know you weren't in the legislature at the time, but you certainly have communications with those folks. Why, when the legislature met to combat this ordinance, did they not just say, you can't do this? Why did they tack things onto it that killed other previously passed ordinances, not only in Charlotte, but civil rights protections for special groups in other municipalities? And it went a couple of steps further than that. Why did they feel it necessary to go beyond simply striking down the ordinance?
My sense was, not being in the room at the time when it was discussed in caucus and so forth, my sense is that they want to clarify certain provisions of existing law. If you look at the bill, some of the elements that are in the bill are actually referencing federal law, in particular federal labor law. So if you look at the term, for example, protected class, to the average person, that seems to indicate a certain type of thing, a way of thinking or so forth. But when you look at actual labor law and federal labor law, protected class has a very specific meaning. And transgender, gender identity, for example, under federal law is not a protected class.
So if we're talking vocabulary and legal terms, why can't Democrats and Republicans, why can't Raleigh and Charlotte get together and hash this out at a table and come up with something that's acceptable to both sides? It's vocabulary, isn't it?
We could. We could. We have some of those discussions had taken place over the last few months. The legislature, I know the leadership of the legislature had been willing to have those conversations since the day it was passed.
Is that true, John?
There were lots of discussions going on. There were lots of phone calls going on. And as to whether Charlotte should repeal its non-discrimination ordinance, I believe HB2 nullified the ordinance. And Scott was in the legislature in May when there were versions of a couple of different bills.
But we have suffered economic impact from the passage of HB2 that cannot be denied. I don't care what the governor has said or what other people have said. There has been economic fallout to this. So in the only way to reverse that is to repeal and maybe repeal and replace, to borrow a phrase, HB2 ultimately. And to do that, you would have to repeal the ordinance, because if they repeal HB2, the ordinance goes into effect, doesn't it?
Well, there were two versions of a couple of bills in May that were being bantered around amongst leadership in the legislature that did not require Charlotte to do anything, that were being discussed as fixes or replacements for the original HB2. Neither one of those bills required Charlotte to do anything. And the legislature didn't need Charlotte to do anything to pass HB2, mm-hmm. and they don't need Charlotte to do anything to repeal HB2.
But those bills, whatever theories that were talked about, clearly were not passed or even brought onto the House floor. So clearly there weren't votes. At the end of the day, you have to have 61 votes in the House and 26 in the Senate. So
this was an election year. How much of this impasse is strictly because it's an election year and it's a point of honor or a point of political I don't know how to describe this. Republicans don't want to give. Democrats don't want to give because it's an election year. How much of it is that?
I think 100% of the reason why Charlotte did not do something with the ordinance was because it was election year. It's been reported in the media that there were people working behind the scenes in the Democratic Party, whether it was Roy Cooper or Becky Carney being another one, that said, don't do this. This is a winning issue for us. We think we can win not just the governor's office. We think we can maybe even pick up the House and Senate if HB2 is still in play on Election Day.
Well, you lost the governor. You may lose the governor's office. It's becoming increasingly difficult, it seems, for the governor to win re-election here. And in part, it could be because, at least in the urban areas, it could be because of HB2, but maybe not. The Democrats did not pick up the seats that they thought they would pick up as a result of HB2. So clearly, it did not work to your advantage as a Democrat, John. So now is there room to talk?
In my opinion, absolutely. I've been willing to talk for quite some time. I would encourage members of City Council to talk. I'm open to talking. I've tried to engage the mayor in a conversation with this for weeks. She has no interest in even having a dialogue. That's been one of the most frustrating things. She's been very obstinate in even having any kind of conversation with me or leadership or anyone else.
John, she's from your party.
I believe there was a meeting scheduled part of September, around September 20th. Certainly the incidents of, around September 20th kind of took the attention away.
But from your experience on City Council and what you know of Mayor Roberts, is it a non-starter? Is repealing the ordinance a non-starter? Is removing these protections for transgendered people a non-starter?
I would have trouble supporting it. When I was on council, and I'm still on council until
supporting
January
what?
11th,
repealing it?
Supporting repealing the non-discrimination ordinance that offers protections to the people that are the most vulnerable in our community, protections that are already legal in about 22 other states and 200 other cities in the country. So this is not some experiment about gender identity. These are protections that corporations who do business with Charlotte want to see so that they can recruit and retain the best quality personnel to continue to grow their business.
We had a forum on this right here at Spirit Square, and we had a representative whose name I cannot bring up in my brain right now, but he was a Republican in the legislature who voted for HB2. And at that forum, we had several transgendered individuals, one on the panel and several in the audience who came forward. That would be Craig Horn, who is the representative. And I asked him, now that you've met these, because he had never met transgendered individuals, now that you met these people, which bathroom here in this building would you say they should use? And I think his answer was, we probably need to revisit this. What would your answer to that be, Scott?
I think what the legislature tried to do with HB2 was to try to get some kind of definition to biological sex and gender identity, and there's a lot of complexity to it. So I think while that part was well intended, from a just try to put a legal frame to it, it's very difficult to do that. That's why I don't think we had an issue beforehand with the bathroom issue, because it was somewhat self-regulating. And for people who look like they should go in one bathroom versus the other, people weren't really, in most cases, bothering them, I don't think. And one of the things I want to address that Representative-elect Autry brought up was the protections that exist and exist in other cities. The bathroom element and being able to choose the bathroom that you want to use, that is not necessarily in 200 cities. It's some non-discrimination protections are in 200 or 300 cities. And I don't think if the city council had brought up certain non-discrimination elements, I doubt we would be here if it wasn't for the bathroom part that was put in. That was certainly the most salacious and attention-grabbing.
And it was a villain that didn't exist, that sexual predators were waiting for the city of Charlotte to pass protections for LGBTQ people in its non-discrimination ordinance so sexual predators could start preying on women and children in the women's restroom. There is no data anywhere in any of the other cities that have these protections that support that myth.
And in truth, these people have been using these restrooms all along, and there has been no report of any problems as a result of that. So this
Which is why we didn't need the ordinance in the first place.
What about that?
Well, I would say that the businesses that are doing, like Bank of America, like Wells Fargo, like PayPal, they want those kinds of protections in the communities that they're existing in and doing business in.
Well, where did this come from? Many people see this as coming from out of nowhere, and it was an election year, so was it a way to put in front of people a reason to vote for Democrats over Republicans? What was it? Where did it come from? If there's never been a problem, and people have been using these bathrooms for years as transgendered individuals. Why did we suddenly need this ordinance?
This was brought to my attention by Scott Bishop with MECPAC, the LGBTQ Political Action Committee for Mecklenburg County, in the summer of 2014. And we started working with the city attorney and working on language to amend the non-discrimination ordinance that was defeated in it didn't pass in 2015.
Right.
And then MECPAC and Equality NC and the HRC came into town and endorsed candidates for city council in 2015 that were supportive of adding LGBT protections to the non-discrimination ordinance. And all but one of those candidates was elected to council. So it just seemed like the best thing to do was to bring the issue back up again and move it through.
Why does the legislature care?
Well,
if Charlotte wants to do something that nobody else in the state does, why do you care?
Well, there's two things. One, I'll answer that, and I want to address something that the Representative-elect Autry just brought up. The legislature cares because when Charlotte does something and there's a precedent set that one municipality can do something, then every municipality can do something. That's why we are a Dillon Rule state. That's why in Charlotte being the biggest city in the state – They're the ones that get the most attention when they do things. So, is it now Charlotte, then Asheville, then Raleigh, then
Why does it matter?
Why does it matter? Because I think the majority of people don't agree that you should be able to choose the bathroom that you want to go into. I think that's the issue. But one thing that I want to bring up.
But wait a minute, Charlotte's duly elected representatives, who the people elected to office, made a decision. If the voters don't like that decision, they will most likely be voted out.
I think they will honestly be voted out.
But isn't that how it works?
But we're 2 years later, and we're still dealing with the issues after the fact. But one thing I thought was very interesting that I just heard was the Human Rights Campaign and Equality NC and all these outside groups outside of Charlotte came in and put a bunch of money into our local races outside special interest groups.
Isn't that how it always works?
Not in a local race like this. Usually a local municipal election is supported by local Charlottesians. There's very little outside money. And in these legislative races, in the governor's race, and across the state this last year, in the past few months, the HRC put in a ton of money. They spent millions.
But Republicans often complain, and with justification, about federal overreach into the states and other areas as well. I know that we're a Dillon Rule state, and we've talked about this a million times, and I'm not sure we've ever talked about how we became one or whether or not we have to stay one.
Right.
But that's another show. Isn't this an example of legislative overreach into municipalities? What's the difference? If the federal government comes in and says, well, you have to have these ordinances because you'll lose Title IX money, you complain that that's overreach.
Mm-hmm.
How is this not overreach when the legislature comes into Charlotte and overturns a decision that the duly elected representatives of Charlotte have made?
Well, I think you could say whether it's this issue or other issues that a local municipality passed, if you've got an ordinance that they have passed, which frankly, they're as we're a Dillon Rule state, they're not technically allowed to do, and then that ordinance is enforced locally, then what's to say that take bathrooms out or LGBT issues out, what's then to stop any city or any town across the state from just doing whatever they want to do, whatever ordinance they want to pass?
Why not?
Because that's not the law, and that's not how our state constitution is set up, and that's how the majority of states are set up. Those rights that are not designated to the local municipality are reserved for the state, just like the federal government. Those issues that are not reserved for the federal government are reserved for the states. That's just how our Constitution is.
So both of you represent Mecklenburg County now in the legislature. You'll take office in
January.
In January. Mm-hmm. You've been in office since May, and you'll start serving your full elected term in January. You're both from Mecklenburg. Will you
Absolutely.
Start a dialogue in Raleigh over this issue?
I think we already have. I think that dialogue is going to be ongoing. I'm troubled by the thought that if Charlotte does something that it has a negative impact on every other municipality in the city, in the state, and the thought that one size fits all is not going to continue to work for us as the growing and prospering municipality that Charlotte is.
So
Charlotte
from your experience, John, on city council and now in the legislature, I know they want us to repeal the ordinance, and we've said we don't have to, and nor will we, in order to repeal HB 2. What has to happen in Charlotte and Raleigh, in your opinion?
I think Raleigh has to be responsible and provide protections for everybody in the state, and they could do that. And they don't need Charlotte's permission to do it or any other municipality's permission.
What's your take on that? Same question, Scott Stone.
Well, protections is a very, very broad term. What are those protections? So forth. If there are there are certainly occasions where someone is assaulted. Perhaps it's because they're a member of the LGBTQ community. If that's the case, that's fine. We need to address that. We need to. That is against the law. That is.
But the question is, what needs to happen in Raleigh and Charlotte for us to move forward?
Well, what I think has to happen is that City Council has to repeal. They have to repeal the ordinance.
But if they do that, are there any guarantees that you'll repeal HB 2?
I think what would need to happen, if there's willingness to do that, that's where the discussion has. Because I don't think the city council would want to, nor is it right for them to pass, to repeal their ordinance if they don't have some kind of sense that we're going to do that. And I know that because I have to count 61 votes, if that's something we want to do, then I think that's where it's got to start.
The economic impact for Charlotte has been in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and over the weekend we witnessed an ACC playoff game that was supposed to have been played here, and it wasn't because of HB 2. So is Charlotte saying anything in 20 seconds or less to these major organizations that have removed economic impact opportunities to say, look, we tried to do the right thing. Don't punish us. Have those conversations happened?
Those conversations have happened, and they will continue to happen. Charlotte did the right thing. Charlotte will continue to do the right thing, and Charlotte is a welcoming community.
Are either of you optimistic that we can get beyond this, John?
Yes.
Yes. Optimistic, yes.
All right. We'll hold you to it. Scott Stone, Republican in the State House. John Autry, Democrat, taking office in January. Thank you.